Title is Research Approaches for Comparing Grazing Management Strategies. Talk is given by Lynn Sullenberger, University of Florida.
Good morning. I'd like to begin by thanking the organizing committee for the opportunity. I'm going to try to, I'll be building on some of the things that Rob has already developed. You'll recognize a few slides. The other thing I would mention is that it's my goal throughout this presentation to raise some issues, to raise some questions. I'm not trying to cast dispersions or be critical of particular people or approaches, so if it appears that I'm being critical, it's simply to enhance discussion and encourage us to think about some issues. I'm basically going to hit three main topics: why conduct grazing research, the current context within which grazing research is being conducted, and then focus on methodological concerns. The first two will go by very quickly. You'll think it's going to be a 7-minute talk, but the last one takes a little while, so don't get too excited, you know, when I'm 5 minutes in and done with the first two. Well, I'm not aware of any 12-step programs for grazing scientists, but perhaps there should be. Some of us just can't seem to control ourselves. We always want to do a grazing trial. But there are legitimate reasons for carrying out grazing research, and I've listed a couple of them here. They provide guidelines for practical grazing and nutrient management practices for producers. They provide animal-based comparisons. We consider animals to be the final answer. And they provide basic information on biology of the grassland ecosystem. And we've done a lot of work on plants and livestock, not nearly enough work on soil, water, and wildlife. One third of the talk done. Okay, let's move on then and look at the current context within which we're working in our grazing research. I'm going to address a few topics: fewer scientists, funding dilemmas, achieving meaningful timescales, remaining relevant, and quantity versus quality. In this case, I'm talking about research, not forage. Monty Roquette published a paper in 2009 where he looked at this issue of fewer scientists. He showed some data that from 84 to 2008, we had a 60% reduction in per state full-time equivalent positions for 14 Southern land-grant universities, and a 36% reduction in teaching FTEs. Fewer of us, no big news. Funding dilemmas in terms of grazing research. Federal funds have been a difficult issue for many years. Survival for many of us has been based on grazing research that has an ecosystem slant or focus. State sources that some of us used to rely on are increasingly hard hit and difficult to acquire. Biomass money has been a bridge for many of us. Unfortunately, at this point, we don't know what's on the other side of the bridge. Hopefully not one of those bridges to nowhere. What's coming? Don't really know. User pay, on-farm studies, how are we going to fund this kind of research? It's a difficult challenge. What about the issue of achieving meaningful timescales? It used to be that there was a stable base funding that would allow scientists to pursue a particular research interest or angle for many years. That's not been the case for a long time. Unfortunately, funding priorities of granting agencies often change faster than questions can be answered, which creates some dilemmas for us. And another issue that I've noticed recently is that universities, in response to evaluation criteria, are looking carefully at throughput of graduate students. More is better, and that has some impact on timescales and research. What about remaining relevant in grazing research? Who are our clientele? We have a traditional land grant mission. Is that still the clientele base for whom we're working? Similar question, whose problems are we addressing? The problems of producers, the problems that granting agencies have prioritized, that's a significant question in my mind. Another question for each of us as we think about our careers is it possible to achieve both scientific impact and practical relevance? Do we hang our hats on the number of papers we've published, the number of questions we've solved? This is related to that last comment, and that an issue of quantity versus quality, activity versus problem solving. We're generally evaluated on quantity, to a lesser extent on quality, on number of new products as opposed to problem solved. Should or how can scientists and their administrators transition to a problems solved basis for evaluation? Not only in grazing research, but other areas. Are we as scientists and the people we work for able to distinguish between activity, which is very easy to observe, and productivity, which is much harder to measure? So those are some of the issues that I think we face within the broader research context, not only grazing, but particularly grazing. And now I want to focus on methodological concerns in grazing research. Can't give a broad coverage of every issue, so I've selected a few. Some of these are issues that Rob has already hit, and so we'll move through them fairly quickly. Just as a prelude to that, I would say that sometimes we complain that our science is underappreciated. And I would argue that sometimes our research methodologies are the cause of our science being underappreciated. And sometimes we just need to sharpen it up a little bit and stop talking about being underappreciated and make our work look like science. Okay. What about methodological concerns? Going to hit terminology again. Length of trials is an issue. We'll talk about mob stocking, sampling strategies for stocking method comparisons, and then lastly, decision points in animal performance trials. All right. Any game, you've got to know the X's and O's, right? So we start with terminology. I was part of a SEEP review or synthesis, and during that process, I found that terminology is highly variable among grazing scientists. It's inconsistent within a research program and even within a publication, and sometimes it's not interpretable. One of my colleagues, John Moore, had a term, fog factor. Many times we were sitting beside each other in seminars, and he would look at me when things were becoming very obtuse, and he would say, fog factor. And I knew exactly what he was talking about, totally uninterpretable. And in many cases, our terminology leads to a very high fog factor index. Well, so how do we go about clearing the fog? And this is a repeat of what Rob indicated, but clearly Vivian and this committee's work has done, I think, a yeoman's effort and put us a long way toward clearing up the fog. And there's the reference to that publication. I would just make a couple of comments relative to terminology. I think many of us coming out of other writing traditions look at creativity and word choice as being a good thing. Within the forage literature, there's a lot of creativity, but that sometimes increases the fog factor. And so I think we need to focus on specific terms. And I just pulled out a couple. Potential utilizable forage. I have no clue what that is. Forage quality on offer. I can guess, but I really, again, I have no clue what that is. If we're thinking about, and just as an example, quantity responses, we really need only three terms. Forage mass, what's there right now? Forage harvested, what's removed by livestock or by mechanical defoliation? forage accumulated, change in mass over time. Three simple terms, consistently defined, consistently used. And the other issue when reviewing the literature, it's really frustrating when someone has measured what you need for them to have measured to, you know, kind of interpret the data, but they haven't defined it or described it in such a way that you really know what it is that they've done. All right, so those few words on terminology. Let's move on to length of trial. From a methodological perspective, short trials increase risk. Increase risk of invalid conclusions, increase risk of inaccurate recommendations. They often fail to represent the variability that's associated with the environments within which we're working. But from a practical and perhaps somewhat mercenary perspective, short trials increase the number of publications per year. They decrease the dollar spent per publication, and they can increase the throughput of graduate students. So there is this tension based on how we're evaluated and the issues that we wish to solve scientifically. A couple quick examples. This one, a little grazing experiment that we did, looking at two cultivars of Rhizoma peanut. They're called Arbrook and Floragraze. Arbrook is upright. Floragraze is more decumbent. They were stocked continuously to a canopy height of 15 to 20 centimeters over a couple of years, and we looked at pasture and animal responses. Quick summary of the data. If we look at year one and year two, we were able to detect no differences in the botanical composition of the pasture. Percent rhizoma peanut, not different in either year. If we look at animal performance, likewise, no different in either year. So, what's next? Well, seems pretty clear. We publish the paper. We report that the persistence is similar for the two cultivars. There's no difference in forage quality. Well, then it was heard among graduate students in the lab that he wants to run the trial for a third year. Oh, my. So, oh, what the heck, let's humor the old geezer and let him do it just to quiet him, and we won't mention who the old geezer is. All right, well, what do we find in year three? Well, it seems that little blip that we saw in year two was actually something important. In year three, it turns into a full-blown effect where Arbrook is not very persistent under continuous stalking in the long term. And if we look at the animal data now below it, the change in composition from peanut to common Bermuda grass has resulted in a significant effect on animal performance. So there is risk, there's danger associated with short-term trials. Another experiment with peanut where we started with pastures that were 80% peanut, 20% perennial grass, imposed three levels of residual forage mass, four levels of rest period between grazing events. These are data from Ortega. In year one, these are response contours, and if you look here is the forage mass variable, the rest period variable here, and then contours of equal response. If we look at that, 65% is the minimum legume we achieved over the grazing season. Looks pretty good. We might conclude there's not a whole lot of danger in terms of a wide range of grazing managements on rhizoma peanut. We continue the study for a second year, and we see that frequent close grazing, which would be down in this area, is significantly depleting the rhizoma peanut stand, and we're running into some serious problems if we continue that type of management over an extended period. So bottom line is that particularly when we're dealing with persistence, long-term studies are critical. And even though it only takes 2 years to get it in the journal, that may not be enough to get a good answer to the question that we're asking. All right, we're going to make a couple of comments about mob stocking. And again, Rob has addressed this, but I'm going to look at it from a little bit different perspective, perhaps. It's defined as a stocking method where we use a high grazing pressure for a short period of time to remove forage rapidly. And despite what you might read in the literature, the term does not imply anything about the rest period between grazing events. It doesn't imply that we're grazing mature forage. It doesn't imply that we have high levels of pre-graze forage mass or low levels of pre-graze forage mass. All it implies is that we're utilizing a short occupancy period. And in fact, any level of stocking frequency and intensity can be used. What about its use as a research tool? Just a couple of concerns. I've observed, and probably you have if you've done these studies, some abnormal grazing behavior. Another issue that sometimes we forget is that animal preference and persistence can be confounded if experimental units are not separately fenced. And what I mean is, here in this study, we have one block of treatments of different entries. If they are not individually fenced, if they're grazed collectively, preference differences among those entries can be confounded with our measure of persistence. And that's a critical issue when you're doing these kind of experiments. One thing to keep in mind is that nutrient redistribution, when we have these very short residence periods, is typically not representative of what would happen on larger pastures. And as a result, using mob stocking as a tool for nutrient cycling and nutrient distribution in grazing studies is probably not a very good idea. There are examples of success of using mob stocking. Ken Quesenberry used this technique to evaluate a wide range of lympho-grass entries, and as a result, selected a very persistent type to be released to producers. A number of other studies have looked at the interaction between stocking frequency and grazing intensity to develop grazing management recommendations, and those have been successfully defined and implemented. Here, going back to the Ortega data, at the end of 2 years, and these are just data from the very end of that experiment, looking at the interaction between forage mass, residual forage mass, and the rest period between grazing events, you can see that a mob grazing trial can help us to identify a sweet spot in terms of persistence of a legume in this case. So we've looked at terminology, length of trials, and the use of mob stocking as a technique. Now I want to talk about sampling strategies for stocking method comparisons, and I'll focus on continuous and rotational stocking. Relative to its impact on the system, I think we could perhaps suggest that stocking method comparisons may have received a disproportionate amount of attention. David Bransby once stated that there are few topics in agriculture that have been addressed with such charismatic language and such abandonment of scientific evidence and logic as this conversation of rotational and continuous stocking. Well, I'm not known for charismatic language, and I'll try to avoid abandoning scientific evidence and logic as we move forward. There are a number of factors that affect the fairness, the validity of comparisons of stocking methods in the literature. A couple of those that I've identified and I'm going to mention briefly. Timing of pasture sampling for forage mass or nutritive value comparisons, and choice of fixed and variable stocking rate, which is an issue that Rob addressed briefly. This is a study done by Bertelsen et al. In 1993, and I'm not criticizing these folks, I'm complimenting them, because they had the foresight and the understanding to know that the timing of sampling of continuous and rotationally stocked pastures drives the nature of the conclusion. And so they looked at a couple of different chemical constituents, measures of nutritive value, protein, and digestibility for three different grazing methods, two rotational systems with 6 and 11 paddocks. They sampled the pastures either pre-graze or post-graze, and they also took esophageal extrusus samples either at the beginning or the end of a rotational stocking period. You'll notice when they sampled pre-graze that the rotational treatments had lower NDF and higher crude protein. If they sampled post-graze, they found in this particular experiment no difference between continuous and rotational. The extrusa samples at the beginning of a grazing period of rotational showed, again, an advantage in terms of lower MDF and higher protein for rotational. If they sampled using fistulated animals at the end of a grazing period, they showed an advantage in terms of lower MDF and higher crude protein for continuous. So, if you look across the top, we have rotational is better than continuous, rotational is equal to continuous, and rotational is inferior to continuous. And in fact, you know, rotational stocking based on this array of sampling can result in better, the same, or worse nutritive value than continuous, depending on when we sample. All right. From that, we conclude that sampling is pretty important, and timing of sampling is critical. So, and also another issue is that samples must be taken to represent the portion of the grazed canopy. Often folks are sampling continuously stocked and rotationally stocked pastures to the same stubble height, and they're not being grazed to the same stubble height. That's a critical error that results in a lot of confusing data in the literature. The second issue is this choice of fixed or variable stocking rate approach. These are some of the data that Rob referred to in the SEEP review. 81% of the experiments showed an advantage for rotational over continuous in terms of some measure of forage quantity. But only 27% of the experiments showed an advantage of rotational in terms of production per unit land area. So the question then is, does research approach have a role to play? And this is a similar figure to one that Rob showed looking at gain per animal response, where our conclusions are basically the same, whether we use a fixed stocking rate methodology or a variable stocking rate methodology. However, and again, Rob showed a similar figure, if we look at the gain per unit land area response, we see a much different story. In the case of a fixed stocking rate, we would conclude that there's no difference, but in variable stocking rate studies, we would say that, in about 40, 45% of the studies, we're seeing an advantage for rotational. Clearly, our conclusions are somewhat different depending on the approach we use. So let's think about why that's the case. Nearly all of the studies that use fixed stocking rates used one level of stocking rate. If we're calculating gain per unit land area and we fix stocking rate, the only way we're going to have a difference between the two treatments, continuous and rotational, is if ADG is different. We've already shown that in most studies, ADG is not going to be different. And so we're effectively determining the results in some way in advance of conducting the experiment. So what's needed for a fair comparison? Let's look at variable stocking rate first. We need to compare forages at the same allowance, forage allowance or grazing pressure. And there's some information on that in a previous publication. We can measure greater forage production if it occurs indirectly in a variable stocking rate study by changes in average stocking rate because we're varying stocking rate based on forage mass or some other pasture characteristic. We can also measure forage accumulation directly to quantify differences in pasture productivity if they exist. All right, let's look at fixed stocking rate. We can compare these two methods at the same stocking rate, but multiple levels are going to be needed, and we're going to get to that in just a second. We can measure also forage accumulation directly to make valid comparisons of forage accumulation between continuous and rotational using a fixed stocking rate approach. Or, if we have multiple levels of stocking rate, we expect the productivity advantage of rotational stocking is going to be in evidence at high stocking rates. So why is that the case? And is there any support that this indeed happens? Let's look at a couple of studies from the literature. This is Garish, published in 2000, looking at four different stocking rates, comparing continuous and rotational stocking. At the low stocking rates, continuous, this is live weight gain per unit land area, gain per hectare. Their rotational is 3 or 9% less in terms of gain per unit land area than continuous. However, and this is a cool season grass legume mixture. At higher stocking rates, rotational 8%, and at the very highest stocking rate, 37% advantage. So, if we're wanting to compare continuous and rotational stocking using a fixed stocking rate approach, that's valid, but you need to use multiple levels of stocking rate because the advantage in terms of quantity is only going to show up at high stocking rates. Another study done by POP, very quickly, just note two different stocking rates, continuous and rotational the same. At the low stocking rate, some advantage here at the rotation, for rotational at the high stocking rate. And if you looked at the posters yesterday, Dr. Riquette had a poster that had some data that would also support this general conclusion. So in terms of interpretation, sampling and choice of stocking rate approach can greatly influence the results of grazing research comparing stocking methods. We need to really be careful in terms of how we design those studies and how we take samples. Brisky stated, a continuation of costly grazing experiments adhering to conventional research protocols will yield little additional information. This is my personal interpretation. Comparison of animal performance under rotational and continuous stocking at one fixed stocking rate is a waste of time and resources. I suggest fishing. At one forage allowance has questionable value because the results are predictable. We have enough data on this already. We don't need to do it again. It should be done only if the experiment is at a sufficient scale in terms of time and number of treatments to quantify effects on soil, water, and wildlife, which are data that we don't have. Okay. All right. Last point, looking at decision points in animal performance grazing trials. I want to look at four questions that we need to address as we design these studies looking at animal performance. Stocking method, continuous or rotational, or some variation on the theme. What grazing intensity variable do we wish to choose? An animal-related variable or a plant or sward rate-related variable? How many levels of that intensity factor do we need? If we choose sward state as our grazing intensity variable, which measure is of particular relevance? Well, if you can interpret this slide by looking at it, you probably have a warped mind, but let me kind of get you up to speed with what I'm talking about here. The first two topics often generate a whole lot more heat than light, very similar to the fiscal debate that's going on in our country right now. The point that I would make is that those first two decisions that we're talking about should not be orthodoxy, should not be set in stone, but they should be objective driven. There's no one answer for all situations, and you do need a specific reason for your choice for a particular study. So unlike the fiscal debate in the country where people tend to get etched in stone and stuck in a rut, as grazing scientists, we need to think about our objectives and then allocate methods based on those objectives. What about the number of levels of intensity that we need to look at? Well, for a simple answer, 3 if you can, and 4 if you get a really big grant. Okay? And it's a challenge to get to that point, but to get really good data, as Rob pointed out, you know, we want to fit those curves, and the only way we can do that is if we get up to 3. If sward state, which characteristic has particular relevance? Well, we can look at, find my cursor here, forage mass or allowance. We can use canopy height. We could use light interception. One concern is that comparing forages with very different growth habits, we need to be concerned about using mass or height because that can confound our results and advantage one species over another. And in those cases, forage allowance may be very useful. Okay, let's summarize then quickly. Those of us conducting grazing research are doing so in a challenging environment, in case you didn't know that when you walked in this morning. We recognize the fundamental and practical value of grazing research. It's important. Because the number of grazing experiments that will be conducted going forward may be severely limited, it's incumbent upon us to do a good job of selecting important research questions. Morley in 81 said the first step in terms of grazing research should be to sit and think. He says this may include such activities as literature searches, discussions with colleagues, visits to farm, and even doodling on large envelopes. And these are all things that I think most of us do too little of. Lastly, some comparisons simply no longer need to be made unless we're expanding our point of reference to include multidisciplinary teams and a wider range of responses. Lastly, we need to respect our science by using consistent terminology, implementing the best methods, and recognizing the importance of the appropriate length of experiments. Thank you.
We've got about 8 minutes for questions.
Jennifer. Okay, Jennifer raises an excellent point in that if the choice of rotational or continuous stocking is going to alter the composition of the pasture over the long term, clearly that's going to have a significant impact. And if we look, as we looked at those data for the two perennial peanut cultivars, clearly that upright growing type is going to be challenged by continuous stocking. And we saw the impact in terms of animal performance associated with its loss from the sward. Okay, good point. Tom raises the issue relative to forage allowance and challenges my use of it as an indicator of sward state. And you're absolutely correct that it is a hybrid of sorts. It has an animal component and a plant component. And so masses is in the numerator and stocking rate or some measure thereof of animal live weight is in the denominator. But it depends upon a measure of a sward characteristic as opposed to simply being established based on some character like stocking rate. So your point is exactly correct and well taken. Thank you.
I do have a question. Lynn, on your comparisons, your evaluation of fixed stocking or variable or continuous stocking versus rotational. You were looking really at gain per acre and average daily gain, but can you comment on how neither one of those really might tell the story on profitability because of fixed costs of animals and all the other factors that go into an enterprise budget?
I thought I wasn't going to have to give the economic talk. Well, actually, My good friend, Dr. Roquette, sitting in the back, we had a little conversation about this yesterday in front of his poster. And Monty, right now, I'm glad that we did because Dr. Roquette was explaining that even though with somewhat higher stocking rates, he's able to demonstrate higher production per unit land area, that some of his producers were reluctant to move to those higher rates because of some of these very issues that, you raise. So it's not simply what that bottom line is in terms of the amount of animal response, but what it takes to, get there.
Other questions? Mark.
You mentioned no reason to really do continuous versus rotational comparisons unless we're expanding it to more environmental or ecosystem. I would just say we've got to reiterate what you said about being very careful about the treatments we set up, because if we don't expect a difference in some of the plant variables, why would you in the soil? You know what I'm saying? So we could be doing the same mistake going to even more expense to show no difference between these methods, and how important is it to it? In other words, you can have two well-managed systems that environmentally are the same.
Yeah.
In fact, maybe like Russell.
Yeah. I think your point is well taken, and I'll try to phrase my answer so that I repeat the question effectively. But I guess I would argue that we know, or I feel comfortable that the literature tells us what to expect in terms of the pasture.